I look back, definitely with more clarity. At one point in the last years, I was just like, oh yeah, look, music was definitely the only thing that was kind of null at times in my life. And just thinking about that whole story and how it changes without music, I don't think it would have been a very long would have been a very long story. Like I the way that I thought of myself, the way I viewed the world, all these things just weren't working very well. But then when I played music, I didn't have to worry about any of that stuff.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Chuck Kopanis is a Winnipeg-based Ojibwe musician from Animaki Wajing 37. In this episode, we talk about Chuck's excellent album, Oshki Manitou, which expands his work as a trumpet player, arranger, and composer. He's woven together ceremonial sweat lodge melodies with jazz, funk, dance, and electronica, and this episode features tracks from that album. Chuck is such a powerfully lyrical trumpet player and also has a really inspiring story of moving through trauma and addiction to helping others through counseling and music. You'll find Chuck's website linked in the show notes where you can go buy his albums and see what his current projects are. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. Please do share this episode with your friends and consider supporting the series by buying me a coffee. The link is in the description. Now to the episode. Hi, Chuck. Thanks so much for joining me here today. I thought it would be great to start with some music early in the episode, as I like to do. And you released the single Creator before you released your last album. So maybe if you could talk to that track and we could play some of that and then
For
get
sure.
into some more of your history.
Yeah. This song, Creator, I was actually just listening to it last night for the first time in a while. And this song is based on a melody that's called Creator's Helper's Song. And I think the first time that I heard this would have been in my first sweat lodge was in 2014, the end of 14. And I would have heard this song somewhere in the next few months after that. Because once I went to that first lodge in the fall of that year, I went on this huge sweat lodge binge that was about 2 years. And I was going to lodges and different other ceremonies like almost every weekend, sometimes multiple times a week. And what I'm finding now is I think people will go like once a month if they're lucky, and sometimes a little bit longer, or sometimes if people are more involved in ceremony, they'll go like once a week or whatever like that. So I was super. Like once I got to that first lodge, I was just like something pretty. I just knew I was onto something that I really needed to do, and I guess I had the time. Like I didn't have kids, and I was just kind of my own. So I would have heard this melody somewhere in that period of time. I think it was the next spring. After I'd been going to lodges all winter, that's where I was kind of writing at home, and I'd been on a long hiatus from really performing. I've done the odd show here and there, and I wasn't really. There were periods there where I totally thought I wasn't good reading anymore. Like I thought, you know what? I'm a good social worker. Like I'm good with people, and I enjoy that. And maybe that's what I was supposed to be all along. And so I was having those thoughts, and but then I was having also this rebellion inside, and I had people always encouraging me. They just thought it was kind of weird whenever I'd say, "Oh, I don't play trumpet," or "I haven't been playing." They'd just be like, "Well, you should play trumpet." It was never like admonishing. It was always just kind of like it was just like, well, that's just not right. You know, or that's not whatever. And I would be like, yeah. So this tune, I remember writing at home, and I had just started understanding ceremonial melody. I had never really heard the form before, and I never really understood the connection between the drum and the vocal and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's an art form in itself. Yeah, I never connected with it until I went to the Sweat Lodge. And it was almost like that was opened a door. So I was writing in my apartment at the time, just kind of like putting grooves together, just kind of, and I remember this melody was in my mind, and I started writing chords and just kind of saying, oh, I wonder what it would sound like if I sang this melody, and I started putting chords there and making a groove around it, and that kind of just started this, like, I guess just a burst of creativity or whatever centered around that melody. So that's where the song came from. For myself.
You're about to hear Chuck's composition Creator from his album Oshki Manitou.
Right.
You're such a lyrical trumpet player, so singing in your style, yeah. But you actually do sing.
Yeah, that I couldn't have done that at that time. So that was in 2015. So it's now 20, geez, the record came out in 2022. Mm. That's where I started just kind of like singing in the sweat lodge, which is what everybody does. It gives you that time where you really want to participate in all the singing that's going on, if that's what you enjoy. I started learning the songs as I was in lodges, and I started practicing singing like kind of outside of lodges. I was like, oh, I remember that song. And I was just kind of, and I really began to start enjoying like using my voice in the lodges and participating in the songs. So over the next year, I'm still, you know, a work in progress and kind of learning melodies. And in the last year or two, I've started kind of feeling more confident. I think my voice is a bit more controlled, or like if I have to, I can sing songs, or if I feel like I have to, but I'm not like breaking mm-hmm. out my hand drum and just wherever. There's singers that I admire in the community, you know, and I feel like I'm, you know, I'm just not there with those guys. And these are guys that have, some guys that have mm-hmm. grown up with that in their lives, and I wasn't really there either. You know, I didn't have there were people that I knew that were ceremonial, but it wasn't, you know, kind of entrenched in my home life the way that I see some people in ceremonies. Like they've been exposed like for a long time, and I wasn't really there. Like my mm-hmm. you know, I've just been around a few years. For this recording, that was kind of a big thing. Like, am I going to sing was a huge question. Or am I going to ask mm-hmm. a friend of mine to sing? And it was such a... The recording year in 2022 was a whirlwind. I booked the time. I got the funding through my management at the time. Got me a bunch of money. And booked the studio time, and I was just like, I just started recording. I had like a week, and I was just like, okay, we're doing this in this week. It just kind of, mm-hmm. I was like, well, yeah, I guess I'm gonna sing. I was thinking maybe I wouldn't even have singing on it, but this song I wanted to have my friend Scott play, who's a percussionist, and I perform with him pretty regularly. You know, when I don't have when I have a gig where they're like, oh, we want you to play, but we don't want a full band, like we don't want the drummer. So then, you know, I've been playing with Scott mm-hmm. for a while, so he played on this recording. We recorded it live in the studio for those parts, so the drums, guitar, and percussion and bass. We just did a few takes and, you know, just kind of mm-hmm. worked out the arrangement that we wanted, and we're like, okay, that's what we're doing. And then we just like recorded it, and it turned out really well. Like Paul Yee, he played bass as well as engineering on this and setting up all the stuff. He was sitting in there, he's like, and he did all the bass off the floor. So I thought that was pretty amazing when I look back at some of the footage.
I really love the whole album, and I'm hoping we can feature maybe even clips of a few mm-hmm. tracks, because there's a lot of different sounds in yeah. it. But before we get into more of the music, sweat lodges weren't legal in Canada because of the Indian Act before. So it's, I think, 1951. So things in your community really changed. Mm-hmm. Like your grandparents wouldn't have been able to.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that they would have been able to. And I'm not really sure in my community how the knowledge came through. There was some kind of ceremonial leadership or medicine men, I guess you would say. But there was like a ceremonial community that I think probably all across Canada that were like, okay, this is something that we have to hide. So they just went into hiding and then carried it through. So I do remember mm-hmm. someone saying that at points like sweat lodges were happening, but they were, you know, they were totally top secret. They were totally... and it was a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
For sure, because, you know, we've never really had the whole equality in the system. So if we're doing something illegal, it's it's not the same as an Indigenous person doing something illegal in Canada. It's not treated the same. And that's still actually happening now, you know, where if we do something illegal, the consequences are going to be harsher in a general way. Kind of generalizing, but it does happen a lot.
In terms of music we could share, I wanted to ask you, because your tune, Nothing Simple, you have a clip of you performing it live with your ensemble on YouTube. Could we share some of that? Because some people watch the video version of this, and it'd be cool to see, to have people see you play.
Sure, we could do that. That's at Revelstoke. That's the first performance with my new effects setup. Going forward, that's something I'm really excited about. Just kind of building on that, because the technology is there where it wasn't there when I was young, and I really wanted to play with effects. There's trumpet players like Randy Kerr, and there's a trumpet player named Kong Vu, who I thought was super cool, but I think he's based in Vancouver, but he was a really awesome trumpet player.
This is the live version of Nothing Simple, taken from a performance in Revelstoke, and you'll also find this composition on the album Oshki Manitou. This is Brendan Kinley on drums, on guitar Victor Lopez, saxophone Kyle Wedlake, bass Henry Onwuchekwa, and trumpet Chuck Kopanas. I've linked the video on Chuck's YouTube in the show notes for those of you listening to the audio podcast who want to check it out.
Thank you.
So, Chuck, you're Anishinaabe from Kenora, which is close to the Manitoba border, and you live in Winnipeg. Winnipeg has a large Indigenous population, right? But is it, I'm just curious, are people mostly Anishinaabe, or are there Inuit that have come down from up north?
Well, in Winnipeg, I would say Cree people and Ojibwe people, and there's Sioux, which I think is more like Dakota or Lakota. And then there's Dene people from the north and Inuit people from the north. But I would say most people in Winnipeg are you know, when I ask, are usually, you know, Ojibwe or Cree. And then there's other people, there's another, there's Oji-Cree, which is also very, a lot of people, like, from the middle of, there's island lakes, there's some lakes there where there's a huge population of Oji-Cree people. So yeah, this area is, you know, kind of, I would say half and half Cree and Ojibwe. I have relatives who are Cree.
So the name of your album.
So Oshkimanitu, it means basically new spirit. At the time that I started writing this song, the title song, I was taking care of my mom around the year before I think she had a fall, or she had a mini stroke, and she was living in North Otsego where I'm registered. She was working back in near Kenora. And I guess when she had that little stroke, that kind of triggered her memory loss, accelerated it. I was taking care of my mom for a couple of years before she had passed away. And I remember that, I guess it would have been 2017. I was going to lodge and all that stuff. And she really liked that. But she lived in Ontario and I lived here. And so when I started working on this album, my son, he wasn't born yet. It was a really interesting time because my mom, because of her memory of you know, her life was kind of going and she was having these health problems. There were periods of time where, you know, we told me about stuff that happened that she had never told me before. Like memories were coming forward. I'm sure this happens for a lot of people that kind of go through this. So I was able to, the first kind of sounds to this song kind of like really, I really like using synthesizers and I really like using, you know, kind of sounds that kind of create a soundscape and then trying to work on my music from there. And I think that's my electronic background, my electronic music background. I remember just thinking that this sounds kind of like a, you know, underwater. My son was still in the womb at the time and we were waiting for him. I figured I was on the cusp of doing something, some kind of project, and I wasn't even close being ready to be recorded or anything. But I was just thinking, yeah, ask my mom, I'll dedicate this set of music, whatever it's going to turn out to be, I'll dedicate it all to my son who's coming, and that'll be my first present to him. So yeah, that's when I asked my mom, how would I say New Spirit? Because that's the name of the song before. And my mom just said, oh, you'd say Oshkimanitu. Yeah, so I really enjoy that she is kind of a participant and just kind of having, to me, it just kind of makes the whole project, kind of gives it a little bit more life to have a lot of meaning behind it and to have that intention. I think that's what comes through as well. And, in that title song, when I do my trumpet solo in there, I'm really trying to picture like calling him. You know, how would I play if I were calling my son or introducing him to the world or whatever. So I kind of try to just kind of introduce these phrases that would be, that I think would connect to a little kid.
This is the title track on the album, Oshkimanitu.
And so now he's here and he's five. I'm really hoping that he gets into the music stuff. So I bought a piano and he can make a sound on the trumpet, which I think is pretty, like, I was just like this. And he's just like, oh, okay. And he had a C going. And if he blows harder, he can get the G, like the next partial. And I was like, okay, you're doing what 90% of the population can't do, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
As a 5-year-old. So anyways, I'm really hoping there, but we'll see what happens.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode. Yeah, speaking about this, so you got your start in a school music program, and from what I understand, that school you went to no longer has a music program, like many schools.
Yeah, it's actually Lakewood. The school is actually gone. It's called Seven Generations, and it's an Indigenous school in Kenora. But so the public school system, I think they might have moved grades 7, 8, 9 over to the high school that I went to. I'm not really sure what's happening there. But all I know is that the Catholic school board now has the music program, and they have a music teacher there. His name's Darcy Yura, and he's doing a really amazing job. He had me back there to speak, and I'm really happy. And there's Indigenous students. He had me back there to talk to the students and stuff, Yeah, it's really cool to see a guy go to music school, you know. I added him on Facebook so that I could, like, kind of follow these dudes. I think, like, not many people went to music school from Kenora. I think I can kind of safely say that. And I would have to kind of do a little bit of research to find out. But it just kind of wasn't a path as much as it would be in Winnipeg, you know, to have a group of music students that go to high school and then all go to music school. There's just kind of more of a path. Mm-hmm. Kenora definitely doesn't have that path.
But a lot of is a small place, but big cities, it's not every school that has... If they have a music program, they wouldn't necessarily have a band program. They might learn a little bit. You know what I mean? It's just not as robust as it used to be.
Or in the States. I'd imagine the States is like...
Yeah.
It's... When I talk to the musicians, you know, if I can talk to somebody and talk about their path, it just seems like there's these... Mm-hmm. And even just looking on the internet, like the... I like watching the marching bands from different schools, and like those trumpet players, like high school bands and stuff, like they're doing, there's just a huge amount of people all supporting this music, you know, activity. It's I'm like, man, I don't know if there's any Canadian universities that be able to, well, the whole sporting, just everything's bigger down there. It's just lots more people and ever. So,
yeah. It is different. I did talk about marching band culture at Historically Black Colleges with Emily Sankofa recently. And it's, you know, and quite a few of the Americans I've spoken to, they definitely got the start in school in various instruments. And in Canada, it's not. I think we could use some more support. Anyway, I just imagine how your life would have been different if you hadn't had the trumpet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And as the year has kind of gone, and I, you know, I, I look back, definitely with more clarity. At one point in the last years, I was just like, oh yeah, look, music was definitely the only thing that was kind of null at times in my life. And just thinking about that whole story and how it changes without music, I don't think it would have been a very long story. Like I, my behaviors, and any addiction issues that I've had, and since coming to ceremony and realize I still have I still have a huge amount of trauma that I had to work through. But that was like almost 20 years sober, so I'm like 20. And just kind of looking at the whatever amount of trauma, and I can't really explain why or how that just kind of transfers through from one generation to the next, and then transfers through to the next generation. And I just don't think they're the amount of intention. I don't think it's something that really works with your intention. Like, I don't think, well, obviously it doesn't, you know what I mean? If anyone could choose to not transfer their trauma to the next generation, I'm sure every person would choose that. And it wouldn't be such a long-standing issue. So I think when I look back, the way that I was behaving when I was growing up, from enduring some abuse when I was, from outside of my family, when I was very small, that kind of stuff just kind of was already trying to take over, and it was trying to take over my life and the whole, like, the way that I thought of myself, the way I viewed the world, all these things just weren't working very well. But then when I played music, I didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. And so when I was creating music with somebody, or the period of time where, periods like where I'm just working on some piece with the piano player that, and we're going to do a performance, that period of time where I'm practicing with her, I didn't even know anything about her, or her life or anything, but we were getting in on this time where I go and practice with her, and we're just like creating this piece of music that I have to go perform, or I have to go for a recital. And this was in like working on like Royal Conservatory of Music pieces and then other performances like that would come up. So I would get this period of time where it doesn't matter if everything is abnormal, or if it doesn't matter what happened, that's causing me trouble, because I don't really ever really remember thinking about conflicts or anything when I'm working on a Bach song or whatever. I'm just like, okay, I'm working on this tune now. And when I look back, I think that those things were probably immensely valuable to me as somebody who might be severely, as it turned out, I was severely conflicted with the world, and I didn't feel that I was struggling, but I didn't know that either. I actually had to get sober, and this was like after high school, after university, and I had to come back to Kenora, or come back to Winnipeg, or I basically was just had to get out of Vancouver and go for treatment. That's all that was in my head. And the period of getting sober is, that's when I was like, holy man, I really don't know how to live in this world. So the places that I did know how to live in the world was when I was playing music with my friends or using drugs and alcohol. And the rest of the time was, so yeah, it takes a long time to iron all that stuff out, like to get sober and to...
Well, Chuck, I from previous interviews, I understand that you had tried different therapies to deal with these problems, but going to the sweat lodges was really what you needed in terms of the spiritual connection and everything.
Yeah, I think it's it's just it's a journey. And I think there's lots of different analogies that are used, I always like there's the most obvious one. You're like peeling an onion, you get the first layer, your next layer, you get the next layer. And I like that one too, because you end up crying every time you're peeling through a new layer. There's these layers of emotion or these layers of release. That self-realization or realization that you've been kind of looking at things wrong, and you're like, holy man, the whole idea of forgiveness. When I first sobered up, I was just like, I didn't know that I didn't believe in that concept. And it's hard to imagine that I just didn't believe in forgiveness. Like, how did I get through the world? Or I believe that forgiveness had to be earned through a specific amount of something, that it had to be earned. And I didn't know that you can actually live as a forgiving person. And I was like, oh, I'm not that kind of person, And for whatever those reasons, you think you're too weak, and I would never admit that I was weak enough to be a forgiving person. So when I think about these are just concepts that have to change. So as I was sobering up, I started just realizing these things and unraveling these things, and a gift to be able to forgive. But yeah, so the sweat lodge, when I think about getting there, it was after a long period of therapies. It was AA, and to me, AA was mentorship by people that are traveling the spiritual path. And it took a while of being kind of fanatical. And that, to me, I think everyone starts fanatical a little bit in AA, which might be a statement that, if someone's AA, they might go, oh, I'm never fanatical. But when I look back, being really scared of getting using and drinking and clinging to something for support, and then learning. I remember I was frantically in my mind thinking, I have to learn this or else my life is over. And that was just a reality, and for me, because it kind of was, I was losing my apartment, I couldn't pay rent, there was just kind of and it was all directly related to using, drugs and alcohol, and so I went through this, and that was in 2001 when I sobered up, and so yeah, it was a fanatical period where I just did nothing but meetings. And it almost reminds me of when I did nothing but sweat lodges, 15 years later or whatever. And so yeah, the sweat lodges, it felt like all of that was just kind of preparing me for that, And so the sweat lodges, I was a person who had been sober a long time. I had a job, I could pay my rent. I didn't have kids yet, but I still didn't think that I could have kids at that time, or that I kind of thought that window was over. Yeah, the first sweat lodges, really, they're really painful. But because I'd been through so much already, I knew that was like kind of a positive, painful experience, because the songs I was starting to understand, and I was like, that's a huge positive, and so something something was kind of opening up to where I was, it was about self-acceptance. And it was, there was a lot of feelings about kind of not belonging. And sometimes those feelings will come back, you know, nowadays where I'm like, oh, I'm not as spiritual or I'm not as cultural or whatever, these kind of thoughts will come. I have to kind of just keep working on letting those go, because that's not really, it's not helpful. And I wouldn't want anyone else to think that, you know, that you're not Indian enough. You know, I wouldn't want to go into somebody, oh, you know what, you could be more Indian or you could be more indigenous or whatever. And so when I do see that, because I see it, sometimes that's how people treat each other, you know, like in order to be in this ceremony or in order to, that you have to, like they'll put limits on each other in ceremony, or we'll put limits on each other. And it probably happens in a lot of places where kind of humans kind of start viewing some activity as a more of a competition rather than as a spiritual, a place to spiritually grow. You know, maybe in churches, you know, like people compete for positions maybe, or stuff like that, where you kind of lose sight of the actual goal.
When you were growing up in Kenora, it was kind of a segregated society.
I think it was segregated in my view. There were people who lived on the reserves. It seemed like there was not as many other nationalities or other cultures. Kenora had kind of, you know, settlers and then indigenous people. When I look at old footage, you know, that was always a problem, you know, where it was always something that was kind of had a lot of conflict around it. Yeah, the way that there was people who had a lot of privilege or a lot of, you know, resources, and then there's people that didn't. And there was usually, you know, when you look at, I was looking at old CBC footage recently, and the disparity between indigenous, you know, what indigenous people had and what the, you know, the settler was very different. So, but everything was kind of under the carpet when I was growing. And I mention this a lot, like when I look at the school now and how they're kind of educating the students and bringing in guys that are going to share story and all this kind of stuff, like that didn't happen when I was in school. And when I was taught about Indigenous people, we were learning about Southern Ontario, people from Southern Ontario. Mm-hmm. And I don't really remember learning about Ojibwe people of the area, you know, which is a huge population. Mm-hmm. Or I didn't, you know, and that was more like from my family and stuff, you know, and not really acknowledged, you know. And nowadays, you know, a lot of schools are acknowledging, you know, just kind of the existence of Indigenous people, wording, you know, using the word Bigwetch or telling people about that, you know, just kind of like, I'm really liking where things are in that way, and thinking about my kid, you know, he's going to be going through the school system, and he's going to learn a lot more of from me, but I think also that's going to be imported from the schools that he goes to, or I'm going to try to make sure that anyways.
Yeah, I'm happy to see how things are changing now. But, you know, when I was like, I'm in my mid 50s and growing up in Ottawa, the kind of education we were taught in schools about Indigenous people, the impression I remember having was there used to be these people here, and they lived this way, but there was no sense of the present.
Yeah, totally. Hunter-gatherer people. And that's what I remember. That's all I remember, basically.
And in terms of the trauma of the residential schools, now, to keep in mind that this podcast, there's listeners, in last month it was 88 countries. Oh. So a lot of people have no idea about the history of Indigenous people here. So if you could speak to that, I know your family was touched by it, and certainly some of what you were talking about before relates to that story.
So when I talk about the trauma or trauma being passed on intergenerationally, that's what I'm talking about, is I think residential school was a part of that. Maybe, you know, I'm not a history buff or whatever, but maybe a part two, I don't know. You know, there's this initial, you know, okay, we see this huge continent and there's people here, but we want control of that, you know, and I need to get that control somehow. So there's this whole, and there's people that have explored all the history. But residential schools, I think, were a real, to me, were real kind of researched thing by certain people in the Canadian government. I think researched boarding schools and then came up with a formula to put in place in Canada. And it was basically divide the population into really small sections so that there can't be a real, one small section is going to be against the other small section, to be all this competition and for resources that aren't there, you know, but then the other part of that, residential schools, you know, mine was taken from Onigaming Reserve with her sisters and her brothers. So there was 9 of them. And I think they would come back in the summers. My grandma on my mom's side and the grandfather, like when they were kids were taken, it was ridiculous. Like it was kids literally were like, okay, you got to come live here. And if you try not to live, you're going to jail, you know, that kind of stuff. And I can't even imagine how painful that would be, you know. And I do, if I can, I'll think about it and I'll think, okay, I have my son here, you know, and if the government was like, oh, you know what, we think we'll put in residential schools again, I'll have imagination. And I actually think this is why my mom wouldn't share the culture to an extent, or didn't teach us the language, because they're all fluent. Like my mom and my aunties are all fluent. And I really think that idea, what if the government does this again, could have been like, well, you know, you can't trust the government, you know, so I want my kids to be safe, you know. So, and that might have not even been a decision for her, because the residential schools were a place, I think, of mind washing, and they're a place that was meant to, there's lots of quotes, beat the Indian, I think beat the Indian from the child. And so my mom and my sisters, or my mom and her sisters and brothers, endured everything that you hear that is bad about residential schools. And some people have less experiences and some people have more. And that's something that's coming through right now with unmarked graves in Canada, where they're finding unmarked graves or mass graves around residential schools. And I think when I think about that, that would be the more, you know, what my mom and her family had to endure. And then the next step up is people that don't survive, that didn't survive residential schools for whatever reason. And so anyways, yeah. So that, to me, that's the trauma that I talk about that I think my mom unintentionally cast through. And I think it's still, when I think about what I've learned in social, you know, in social services, stories that I've heard, and just kind of observing people through that kind of lens, like these people, people that have shared kind of teachings from school with me, or shared spiritual growth stories with me, and what I've seen with people that get sober and then still have other areas to work on, that I think that residential school sent shockwaves that are intergenerational. And I still think Indigenous people nowadays, it shows itself in different ways. And I think as we're growing as a nation, like as we're growing as Indigenous people, you know, right now there's people winning international awards, you know, there's people that are going to the Olympics. I think as time goes on and as generations keep going on, that shockwave is kind of dissipating, so that intergenerational trauma is just kind of getting weaker. And, you know, I've seen it in high school. You know, I've seen it in the high school that I was speaking at, TA in Kenora, Thomas Aquinas. And I look at Native kids that I was speaking with, and I was just like, what was really clear is like, these aren't having the same experience that I had. You know, it's just obvious in the way that they're presenting, in the way that they're speaking and communicating, you know, and just like, not like everyone's the same or whatever, but I'm looking for, there was nobody that was just against me for no reason, which I was like I was definitely, like when I was in school, I just remember being very conflicted and very argumentative and very, I just had a lot of stuff going on that kind of was antisocial or whatever, just kind of little things. And when I was looking, when I was at these students, I was thinking, oh man, that's so good. You know, it just helped me, it made me feel really good, you know, that. Yeah, that the same, it's not the same, you know, and that's good. I'm pretty sure, you know, and I could probably go across Canada into different places, and I would see that things are different right now compared to when I was, you know, 20 years ago when I was going through.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Chuck Kopanas' composition, Little Sunflower, from his album Oshki Manitou. I encourage you to buy his albums. His website is linked in the show notes. In terms of Indigenous mentorship and music, Chuck, it would be interesting to talk about the project you did with Julia Keefe. And I believe you guys also went to a reserve and did a clinic too, part of that big band.
Oh, man. So we had our first gig. Julia got this band together and we played our first shows. We played in Olympia, Washington. And so that's the area that Julia is from. And I can't remember the name of her people, but we played that show and we all got together and got together for this huge concert. But we ended up going to a community where she was from. And we went to an all-Indigenous school. I wish I could remember the name of it, but that was an amazing experience for me because it was all Indi teachers, all Indigenous little kids, and they had such spirit. And I was just thinking, man, it was a really beautiful experience. And so we went in and played for them, and we went and I did a workshop, and then we played our concert. And that was, for me, that was kind of, I'd always kind of grown up, as since I started playing music, I kind of got used to being the only Indigenous person, and especially like with classical music, I didn't see many Indigenous people. And I might have been actually around a lot, come to think about it, because there's a lot of Métis people out there that I don't think that would don't see that as a really important, and or they wouldn't want to talk about that or whatever. So I might have been playing with Métis people that I didn't know about. Maybe they didn't know. But I remember being in this band and I was sitting next to the trumpet player, I think who probably brought me into the band. His name's Delbert Anderson. And he totally looks like my cousin. He looks like someone that could be like from a different family at my res or from, in Kenora. And the sax player, he's a I think he's a Comanche. And yeah, again, he just looks like one of my relatives. And I think he lives down in the Dallas area right now. And all these other musicians, we all got together and we're performing works by the bass player. Her name is Mally Obansowin, and she's from like the East Coast. And there's that same last name as in Canada as well. Oh, but it's there's someone from Montreal with the name Obansowin. I forget her first name. But I actually think that might be the same last name, or it's actually related last name. So that's like the border between Montreal and the New York area, all this stuff, like all take away all those borders and those people, that I'm slowly starting to learn the history of that area from members of that band. As we're sharing, as we're playing more gigs together, I'm starting to like talk. And there's a sax player named Asa Peters, who to me, he's a really young guy, but he's part of the Mashpee tribe, and he lives around Boston. But they kind of have their teachers and powwows and stuff, but they don't have any land. Like they didn't, their land, like, and I'm just, oh man. Like, and I've always hated the reserve system, or I've always talked out against the reserve system, but at least it's just a place where my family is from, and it's a town isn't going to be built on it, and the system might be flawed, but he lives in a place where the community was there. But it had zero protection. A town just kind of went on top of it. And so all the people that are lived there are it just absorbed into the town and gone. Or not gone, but just kind of like there's no. And I always thought, oh man, well that's strange. It's strange that I would be thinking it's too bad you don't have a reserve. But it's like, but anyways. Yeah, it's a crazy situation, but that band is starting to it's bringing all these jazz musicians from all around North America, and we're all getting to kind of share these stories with each other and kind of share our knowledge. We did that concert, I was like, man, I wish there was a singer here that could sing, an honor song for their first concert or whatever. And then I was like, I was like, damn, Well, I guess there's nobody that's going to sing a song, so I asked if I could sing a song. And I was just like, I think it sounded okay, but I was like, man, it felt like that event of us playing together and starting something that might be, or continuing something like big bands. Indigenous big bands have been around for a while, which I also learned, but they're part of there's been indigenous people in the military. There's been military jazz bands, with indigenous players or in Julia Keefe's area. I guess there was big bands that were part of the indigenous community that I think they were part of schools or something, and they were like, there's old, pictures of a bunch of native kids all playing, jazz music. And I thought that was pretty amazing, and thinking, man, that would never have happened in Canada, So there is this history that we're continuing, and I'm really hoping that that band just kind of keeps growing, or just kind of becomes an established thing, and then hopefully something that can carry forward into different areas, and just kind of looking into the future, is there going to be an Indigenous jazz festival, somewhere in New Orleans, or maybe Gathering of Nations, the huge pow, might have the jazz festival area or whatever. Like, I don't know. So I actually, one of the things I remember thinking, like when I first played with that band, is I didn't think I would see something like this. Like, I was like, this would happen. Of course, this is going to happen. It's probably going to be after I'm gone, that there's going to be enough Indigenous. And all of a sudden, it's happening while I'm alive, and I'm like, "Yeah, I made it!" And I'm one of the old guys, which is something in itself that I'm getting used to, is being the old guy.
So Chuck, if we could go back to your music education a bit. So you had some early jazz experience, like in the community swing band you were able to play in, and it's classical, and then at a certain point you got into electronic music. How did that work its way in?
I guess my path has been pretty kind of zigzaggy or whatever, but I had like a really fast start with music training, and then basically it's kind of like a really fast start, and then just kind of went blah 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 and kind of got fragmented or whatever. But when I was in grade 7, that's when I started playing it, and then my family, once I was good at it, I enjoyed it. I never thought about it, but I realize now that my stepdad, maybe, and my mom, maybe people around were just like saying, like, Chuck is good at something and he's interested in something, so this needs to be supported. And so then my stepdad Peter at the time, he's still in contact with us, even though he wasn't with my mom. He just started, he was paying for my sister's swimming lessons, and he was still supporting me and my sisters in doing stuff. And incidentally, my oldest sister Serena was on her way to the Seoul Olympics. That was the goal with her. Like, she was one of the faster, she was hanging at the top swimmers in the world at the time. And that was when Canada was at the, so there was Alex Bowman, there was Victor Davis, there was Anne-Aught Braight. There was this crew of Canadian swimmers that were at the top, and my sister was kind of, anyways, so my stepdad was supporting her where she was at, and then all of a sudden I became good at music, or I became good at the trumpet, or was discovered. And then in grade 8, Kenora had a community big band, and we basically played two big gigs a year, one at the harborfront for the community, and then one at a hotel for the seniors. And all the seniors in Kenora would show up, and we'd play polka. So they really liked the polkas, and the polkas would just pack the dance floor. That was basically my first, exposure to jazz music. And then I would do solos in the band, and Barry Easton, who was the conductor of the band, I was second trumpet, so I'd always get all the solos, and I would just plan to play the written solos. So they'd be playing In the Mood, there'd be a written trumpet solo, so I'd play that, and I would never actually improvise, because I was really scared of that. And I thought it was just too complex of a thing to do. I didn't know that experience of playing in that big band from grade 8 to 9, 10, 11, 12. When I got to university, I was a great leader. Like when I got into the big band at university, or the band, the concert band, all that kind of stuff. When it came to new pieces, I remember, I can't do it now, but I remember how far ahead I could read. Like when I was playing, I was like, mm-hmm. I was looking. And right now when I try to read, because I don't read a lot, I have to stay on the bar that I'm reading. And with bifocals, it's actually trickier now. But I remember at that time I could read. And when I got to university in the big band there, I ended up being in the senior big band. Usually the first years couldn't go into the senior big band. There was a big band for the first years. But I was only first year that was in the senior big band, I guess, because I had all this experience. When I was going through high school, I was taking theory, and I was taking trumpet through Royal Conservatory of Music. So when I finished high school, I had a grade 10 trumpet, and then I had a grade 8 piano, and a grade 6, mm-hmm. I think it was grade 4, grade 5, something, harmony. And all of that I thought was like not enough when I got to university music. Like I thought, because my music teacher was like, oh, all these guys are going to have like everything. They're going to have way more than you have for training or whatever. So you have to just keep going. And then when I got to university, when I finally got admitted, I was ahead of everybody. It seemed everything that I was, like all the harmony and all the theory, it was second year harmony and theory. The mm-hmm. only thing that I didn't know anything about was music, the music history, the actual trumpet instruction I had never had when I got to university. Like I never really had anybody teach me the trumpet, and I didn't think I needed it, which was, I think it was a little cocky, but when I actually got to the trumpet teacher, he spent the whole first year in Brett, his name was Alan Innes. And I remember every time we went for a lesson, all he would do is just stand beside my trumpet, and he would just watch my lips and watch my position. And he would just be like sitting there going, as I was playing these songs, because I had so many bad habits. Like I would shift around this, I'd move. I had this big mm-hmm. growth on my wrist from holding the trumpet wrong from grade 7 to all through high school. He'd always just be like just sitting there adjusting me. And my air, he kind of showed me how to blow and play the trumpet without using so much muscles, like so much compression, like kind of strength, which is kind of what I was doing at the time. And so when I got to Brandon, music was definitely just a kind of really easy experience. Everything I never found playing very hard at playing the music that we were doing. Like it was really fun. And like I said before, it was, I kind of thought I had things reversed, but I really enjoyed the whole music experience, like going up, because I think it gave me those breaks.
I just realized, Chuck, so you were at Brandon. So was it James Ennis's dad who was teaching you trumpet?
His name is Alan Ennis.
What a cool connection. James was one of my first guests on this podcast, and he talked about his dad, you know, being the trumpet teacher there, and I hadn't made that connection.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. He was, I really liked him. I really liked him, and he chose pieces for me to play that were really cool. Like, I wish I still had them. Like, I lost all my music when I was in Vancouver, and I moved back. I left this giant box. Mm. Like, I had this, like, all my university music, all my books, everything in there. But it had all my Royal Conservatory stuff with the markings, like, just kind of everything that I wish I had still. Mm. But, I remember the song that he chose. I wish I could pull it out and just kind of read over it again, because he kind of chose. I remember I could play Bach or I could play, you know, whatever, but he chose a 20th century music piece for me to play. And I remember really thinking that it was I liked it because it wasn't strictly with the piano at times, and kind of, I guess, mm-hmm. he probably recognized that I was more of a lyrical player, just kind of a unique way of looking at things. And he was totally supportive of that. But mm-hmm. I ended up leaving. I only did the 2 years in Brandon, and I left.
So at a certain point, you decided to go get a degree in social work to work in the community.
Well, what ended up happening is I went to treatment coming back from Vancouver. Yeah, I was 19, so that would have been 99. And so it took me a couple of years to get sober after getting to Winnipeg. And I only came here because my mom and my family came here. Otherwise, I would have went to Thunder Bay. I went to treatment at a place called AFM in Winnipeg. It's called the Addictions Foundation of Manitoba. And AFM was closely tied to Alcoholics Anonymous in Manitoba. And I think AFM actually, it was called the Alcoholism Foundation of Manitoba, and it was kind of born out of AA. Or they came about at around the same time that AA started, you know, forming and getting popular. And so that's where I went to treatment when I got to Manitoba. I went there twice. And I completed once, and I failed once, and then I went to another treatment. So I went to treatment 3 times, and then I gave it up. And that was in 2001. And then in 2004, one of my close sobriety buddies named Dallin, he got a job at the AFM. And at that time, they were still hiring residential care workers from the recovery community. So to hire people based on their kind of sharing experience and sharing their story and just kind of being, having a history of sobriety, obviously. And so that's how I ended up getting a job at the AFM. And then AFM they also have an education portion of AFM, so people can come and take addictions courses, and some of them can qualify towards their degrees. So some, but basically AFM would just give those to all the people that work there for free. So I ended up going and taking counseling courses and different addictions courses there, but I actually never got an actual certificate in social work.
Mm-hmm. So I was just curious, because you're working these long hours in the community, it must take an emotional toll. Would you go and play music to kind of balance that out emotionally?
I think so. I think when I started working at the AFM, that was the first job that I took that was not like physical labor, or not just kind of security work, mm-hmm. or just kind of, you know, kind of work that I wasn't really connected to. And I'd always thought, eventually I'm going to play music. I just don't know what that's going to look like. So went to Winnipeg, I was playing with a band called Moses Mays. And then when I sobered up, I was still playing with them. And I was working at AFM. And then I started working at a homeless shelter called Main Street Project. And when I look back, those first few years, it was all just learning. I was kind of learning about myself as a helper, because I didn't really know that I enjoyed helping people up until like someone just said, "Oh, do you want to try the AFM?" And yeah, I guess that I started kind of exploring myself, like how, as a counselor, or as a crisis worker, or a crisis counselor, or whatever you want to call it, like helping people get through rough periods in the treatment center. But I was also, kind of helping when I was working at Main Street Project. There were a lot of different kind of situations that would arise there, and I started kind of gaining more skills at helping people through, really, people that have become homeless, and they're like, okay, what do I do? Or going through huge loss, or all these kind of things that happened. And I started finding that I really enjoyed that, and I really enjoyed connecting, hearing, encouraging people to share so they can get things off their chest and all this kind of stuff. And I found that I'm really good at that. And I didn't know that it was taking a toll on me, actually, until I was at for quite a while. And then I started kind of learning about trauma and learning about vicarious trauma. And I was actually taking on a lot of stuff, and it was starting to affect me. I started kind of learning about that, and how do you, I guess it's a next level, like how do you work in the social services, go through helping people get through, all these different, this wide array of crisis that they can experience, and how do you connect with people, and how do you disconnect from somebody so that you connect with yourself, all these kind of things that are, I think, is the kind of the next part of learning. Either you do or you don't do, and either do it or you burn out, and people can burn out pretty hard from social service work, which I started seeing, like people that just become so hard to work with. I'll see people now that I'm like, you know what, I can tell that you need to stop working for a while, because I can tell that somebody has just been putting themselves out there for so long that they forget why they're doing it in the first place, because they're not treating people well or treating themselves well, or whatever, like something's off, the balance is off there. So yeah, and then I was doing music just for the first while of that, and then I just started doing that work for quite a while, up until I think about 2012. I think it was about a 5 to 7 year period where I wasn't really playing trumpet at all, and I wasn't really working on music, and it was just kind of really at the peripheral, outside of working in social services. So I'd kind of been doing that for so long that I remember there was a where just nobody knew I was a musician that I was working with. The only people that knew were, like my family, and like I was those people that would remind me. I would see them or run into them at the mall, and they'd be like, "Oh, so how's the trumpet going?" I'd be like, damn, I haven't played in a while. Or I haven't thought myself as a musician in a while.
So Chuck, your first album, it came out a couple years after that.
Yeah.
Was your motivation just to kind of get your music out there to get gigs or?
Well, when that album came out, I knew that I had something recorded. So that was in 2016, I do believe, or 2015. And I started going to sweat lodges in 2014. So that was one of the things that happened from the lodges is, I was working on music and I was like, but it would just go by the wayside so easily, like doing social work and doing my jobs. And as I continued to gain experience in the social service field and get different jobs, I guess I started getting more intense jobs with more responsibility. And so they'd be way more consuming, and like consuming over like the whole day, working at nighttime, communicating with people at nighttime, all that stuff. So I would have these little bursts where I would just be like, oh, I wrote a couple tunes, and then I wouldn't play for a long time. Or I'd have a little burst where, a buddy asked me to play with their band for a gig. So I'd go do that and find that I could barely play, but I could play enough to play the song and play the concert or whatever. But I remember there was one period where I couldn't even play Mary Had a Little Lamb. Like I hadn't been playing at all, and I had just rebuild. And yeah, so in 2014 I went to that sweat lodge, and that was one big thing that happened, because I remember sitting there just kind of being down in the dumps at the apartment that I had and just kind of burning. I think I might have saw in social media like somebody that I know which guy it was, but they were super successful at doing music stuff. And it was somebody that I would have considered my peer a while back. And they were like doing this thing that I want to do. And I was just like, damn, like I could be doing that, and maybe I was just like, and I'm just thinking, yeah, that's what I really want to love. I really want to do, and I'd been to my lodges, and for whatever reason, there wasn't, I wouldn't just put those thoughts aside. I ended up phoning the people that are in my band, right? Like the drummer, specifically Brendan Kinley. I remember phoning him and phoning the bass player Ashley, who played on that first recording, and I asked them if they wanted to be in my band, and they said yeah. And then I booked a gig, and I phoned a place in Winnipeg, and just told them that I had a band and I already had music and all this kind of stuff, just to get the gig. And then that's kind of what started doing that recording is I played that gig, and then I started putting the music together and just kind of choosing stuff from my past, grooves that I'd been working on when I did work on music. And I basically just had this mindset that I'm going to do this. No matter what, I don't care what it looks like. I don't care what it sounds like. I don't care anymore. I was just like, and I don't know where that mindset came from and why it came all of a sudden. I'd probably been depressed like that before. I'd probably been there a bunch of times, just kind of yearning and hoping or wishing or whatever, but it never went in next step, which was I'm going to make this happen, and I'm not going to take no for an answer from myself anymore. You know what I mean? And that's where I feel like right where I am right now, where I'm just kind of like, I don't have a manager anymore, and I'm not the greatest at the funding, like the grant writing and all this stuff, but I don't feel like I'm going to give up. You know what I mean? Like, I could go get another job. I probably could. But in my mind, something's changed where I'm just like, well, I don't want to do anything else. So I quit my job, and it's either do music or I don't know what I'm going to do. I just feel like I don't have a choice anymore, and I used to. And that's what, I think that's what happened with the sweat lodges and stuff. It was just like removed that lock and maybe even shifted it the other way or turned it around where, well, you're doing music and do you feel, are you nervous about, are you nervous about speaking or are you nervous about failing or having a fear of failure or whatever? And that used to stop me, and now it's like, well, we're doing it anyways, so we might as well just not. When I think about in my mind, it's like the dialogue's changed. It's like you better get over it because we're gonna do it anyway. So I don't know why. Maybe there's just some another, and maybe there's another power there. Maybe there's another, maybe that's what happens if you engage your spirit in something, is it gives you extra little entity or that a little thing that's like just kind of creating a different situation internally. I don't know, rearrangement. But yeah, that's where I am right now. Just kind of trying to
Good to hear.
say yes to opportunities. And I haven't been working since May. I got some money from my reserve, my reserve is called Northwest Angle or Animaki-Wajing, and they did a flood claim and they paid out all the members of the reserve a certain amount of money for having their territories flooded out like crazy back in the early part of the century. And once I got that money, I remember thinking, oh, it's going to be nice because I'll be working, plus I'll have this money in the bank. But what I did, I ended up just quitting my job like right away. And I was like, okay, well, here's an opportunity. And I'll get a job if I have to, but right now I'm not going to worry about it. And actually, when I played my gig in Manitoulin Island, an elder there, actually two elders, saw me right away. I was playing on the Wik'wemecong Reserve. They had a little ceremony for me there, and one gave me some medicine for my knees, which really helped actually. But what they identified, or what this woman identified, Michelle, is that I'm a super, that I was really sad. And as we started talking, she identified, helped me identify, like totally counseled me. And I guess I was just right there, like wanting that, although I didn't think that was going to happen. When it's happening, I was like, oh man, what's going on? All of a sudden I'm getting counseled. But she helped me identify that I miss my clients from my old job. So this was in November and I quit in May. And now it's like January. But I think from May until now has been the only time that I haven't been working this job where I'm consumed by the people that I work for. And I didn't know. Anyhow, sometimes for me, maybe for other people, you have to actually do something before you find out why you have to do it. Like, you don't get to find out before. Maybe that's one of the hardest things about being human, maybe, is that sometimes you don't get everything laid out for you. You know what I mean? You just have to find out later. So I think, I think getting the money, you know, it's just kind of opening me up to kind of do all these things that I didn't, you know, that I'd been putting off because I have to work and trying to work and do music. And now I think I would really like to work on work, doing workshops, speaking with people and sharing my story. Also, you know, sharing some recovery, you know, and just kind of see if I can help people connect to music or connect to themselves, you know, or connect to what they want to do, you know, through just kind of sharing things that I've gone through, especially with going to sweats. I do think there's a lot of guys like me out there. A lot of women and men are people that don't go to ceremony because they don't think that they belong there or something like that. And maybe I can help a little bit. Kind of maybe somebody really wants to go to the lodge, but they don't think they have to because they've gone to counseling or whatever. Like they don't think they're going to get what they need there, which I didn't think I needed to go to the sweat lodge, but it turned out I really did.
So Chuck, in these workshops, would you incorporate your music with talking about your story?
I think I would play and I would talk. It's kind of what I do at live performances anyways. And it works really well. I'm finding I get a lot of really positive response from concerts that where people really like the stories, like they like the things that I talk about or the, you know, the story of the sweat lodge. I do like to share a lot. And then also just kind of picking, you know, little, you know, trying to share a bit of that spiritual growth thing. So I think if I were to do a workshop and I'd like to do one with younger people is I would definitely do music and speak. So kind of try to flip things so that it's not just listening to me talk and it's also watching my band play. And this year, you know, I really want to start doing collaborations. So I've recorded my album, I've released it, and I'm trying to like my album to grow. But I'm also thinking about the next, you know, I'd like to do a lot more collaborating with maybe some younger people, especially guys that are, you know, just kind of getting into doing music stuff or whatever. So I'd like to learn the business with them and, you know, just kind of try to keep growing my own profile so that I can, you know, I definitely would like to help other young guys get into music or be able to build path. And I know there's organizations in Canada that I think go to different communities in the north or bring music, bring instruments into the north. You know, I'd like to do stuff like that. I could really build that connection.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your personal stories and how you overcame a lot through music. It's really amazing.
No problem.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.